Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
Tonight's episode, I'm flying solo, and we'll be talking about sacred artistry and an enchanted worldview. We'll have selected readings from a pair of books that have had some strong impacts on me personally with regards to those topics. And then we'll also have an excellent interview with Bree Saucy of Milagro Roots. Stay tuned! Greetings and welcome. This is the first of our episodes during our heavy transitional phase, so please forgive any technical difficulties or flubs or flaws or perhaps late arrivals in the podcast feed for this episode. We are trying to get this out for July, maybe early August before it actually gets posted. But if you are unaware, if this is your first episode tuning in, hello, welcome. But we are in the process of some fairly major changes. I have just completed a move from my former home in the South to Pennsylvania, where I'll be starting a PhD program focusing on American studies. And so in doing that, there was a lot of transition, a lot of upheaval. We recorded some interviews prior to any of this transition so that we would have material. But then, you know, there's additional work that goes into the production of these shows, for instance, editing and putting in opening, closing material, things like that. So there may be some delays, some changes that have to happen. But whatever the case, we are trying to get these out to you as much as we can. And in no way is the transition, and the other part of the transition, I should say, co-host Lane is expecting a baby very, very soon now, which is a huge, major life change. The baby, I don't believe, is due until September, but, that is certainly impacting her ability to do a lot of things, including podcasting at the moment. So we're just trying to make sure that, you know, we have material to kind of cover us over the next couple of months. That's not going to be a problem. But she may be sort of out of commission until after the baby's here and all is well, and she can get back on some kind of regular, normal life schedule as much as is possible with a newborn infant, I guess. So we're super happy for her about that. There's nothing but joy in our hearts over that. But that may also impact us. But as I was saying, none of this is expected to impact our ability to produce shows and expected to impact our ability to produce high quality shows, I hope, for you. And tonight, I think, will be a really fine example of some of the high caliber work that we're hoping to continue to do, even despite some of these changes and transitions. We've got a truly excellent interview with Bree Saucy of Milagro Roots coming up. She'll be talking about sacred artistry as well as kind of the enchanted worldview that shaped her growing up and the enchanted worldview that she likes to share with others. She's just a real gem, folks. It's a real treat to get to talk to her. I've taken a class from her. I've interacted with her in several different ways over the years. She's just wonderful. So I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I did. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Before we do, though, sort of the theme for the show. When I did the interview, I was doing it mostly because, one, I think Bree is wonderful. And two, I had sort of a tentative idea of, because I took a star magic course from her, of maybe putting something astrological together and doing an astrology episode. And Lane and I have touched on that a bit before in our divination episode, but I kind of wanted to focus more on folk astrology, things like that. But through the course of the interview, that really wasn't the direction we wound up going, and what we actually did wind up discussing just wound up being so much better, I think, than sticking to a purely astrological discussion would have been. And so we get into something that's very important to me, which is this idea of an enchanted worldview. And then Bree brings up a really interesting idea about some of these sort of new world practices that become syncretic practices. And there's been a lot of discussion lately, I know, about cultural appropriation, going on just across the blogosphere and the podosphere. What I want to really make a point of is that syncretism and cultural appropriation do not always go hand in hand. They certainly can. It's certainly very easy to pick something up without any respect to its original culture and begin using it with undue authority. That's not where we're going here. What Bree is talking about is this idea of kind of a syncretic practice that grows out of years of experience interacting with the cultures that she's talking about. While I do think cultural appropriation is a discussion that we'll have at some point on this show, really when you hear the syncretism in this, I don't want you to be thinking, cobbled together hastily, out of two books that she's read or two books that I've read or anything like that. We're talking about extensive layers of practice that have been put together. And to that end, really we're looking at this worldview that she has had her whole life, that I have had my whole life as well, of sort of an enchanted world that we live in and sort of a magic of that world. To bookend the interview with her, I thought I would share a couple of small selected readings from some books that have been very, very influential to me in terms of reflecting that idea of an enchanted worldview. One of which we mention in the interview, we mention the author Dry Mikaharitz, who has written a number of books, and we'll be doing a short reading from his book Spiritual Cleansing after the interview. But before the interview, I wanted to read just a little bit from the first chapter of a book called Living the Magical Life by Susie Gablick. Susie Gablick is a professional art critic, more than anything else. That's what she's built her life on, is doing art critiques and art criticism, theories of art, and she's fairly well known for that in that circuit. But she wrote this book called Living the Magical Life, which is all about the developing relationship she found she was getting with one specific spiritual entity, the Black Madonna, who may resonate very, very much with some of our audience here, particularly those who resonate with the idea of dark goddess figures. And so she, at age 50 or so, came to have this really interesting relationship with the Black Madonna. And so I wanted to read a little bit from her book, just to kind of give you an idea of how magical worldview wound up kind of surprising her into a spiritual practice. So, from Living the Magical Life by Susie Gablick, from chapter 1. I like to sit in the evening at my Black Madonna altar, its candles burning as if I were at Chartres or Notre Dame or Saint-Michel. As the incense slowly turns to ash, its fragrance scents the whole house. I like finding out what the gods want, even though I know that finding out what the gods want is held to be of little value in our society and has been discontinued as a practice. Inviting the gods in, I often wonder whether this magical dimension of life eludes us only because we have disavowed it. No longer the critic who stands back to analyze an issue and wearing a different cultural lens. I can now step directly into the drama myself to get at something utterly heartbroken, as Annie Dillard puts it in one of her poems, colors which have no name, but are the real foundation of everything. When I moved to Virginia in 1991, after living in London for more than 20 years, many things about my life changed. Furniture, pictures, views from the windows, and even my thoughts. Most surprising of all was that I couldn't stand anything modern anymore. The tumult of urban cultural life behind me, I wanted to bask in the luxury of a beautiful wooded valley rimmed by hazy blue mountains. Perched on its own little hill, my new home reminded me of an alpine spa. Inside, I hankered after objects that looked as if they had existed since the beginning of time. Plexiglass and steel were unthinkable. They had no texture and no soul. The local flea market soon became my Valhalla, a happy hunting ground for anything with a surface that was bleached, mottled, or weathered. I would quite literally jump for joy at the sight of a beautiful patina. Plowing through piles of depression glass and random heaps of silverware, I looked for extravagant baubles that called out to me. Perhaps it was an awkwardly lumpish peasant doll from Madeira, with babushka and braids, or a whorled and looping Victorian Christmas ornament made of spun glass, or an eccentric candle in the form of a young cadet with Hamlet haircut, wearing a Scottish kilt and standing at attention. The business of the treasure hunt gives you an irresistible part to play in the national pageant. Once you really learn to stalk the piles, you may even catch sight of something William Gass describes in On Being Blue. You will discover the love that hides inside of a glove, and the ass inside of brass. You may even find there is dung inside of dungeon and pee in perspective. Shopping in flea markets is very much like that. You can learn that the things of this world are really containers, and every object is a mythic universe with its own intricate sonorities. It was only after I became interested in making altars and created shrewdly placed arrangements for these objects whose evocative soul dramas had stolen their way into my heart that I discovered a deeper force behind a more mundane motive of shopping and collecting. An altar is the outcome of many separate acts of attention. Making one affords noble, wild prospects for the soul as an expression of the way we arrange things. An altar is a way of orchestrating passion and articulating acts of perception with the whole being. You can make an inspired one with nothing more than the glow of a single marigold, or your love for an old handmade toy, or the ash heaps generated by prayer. In my case, I expect I was half-consciously aiming at finding a magnificent obsession, some way to transcend the ordinary. Alone, I wanted to attune my mind to ways of seeing that have remained hidden or left out in our culture. But what I didn't count on when I made an altar to the Black Madonna was that it would bring about a stupendous change in my entire life orientation. What I didn't foresee was the particular turn my life would take when I discovered in an unsettling way that praying to the Black Madonna works, or that eventually a sense of faith that wasn't there before would appear as if in answer to my prayers. Now when I light the tiny lamp whose purple shade gives off a smoky violet glow and cross over into oracular space, I signify my intention to live mythically and symbolically. I personalize my belief that the universe is communicating with me in a conscious and intelligent way, in a world that mistrusts and rejects magic. I feel as if I am reclaiming an older, half-forgotten way of consciousness, deep down in the senses. When I probe the realm of spirits, I create opportunities to subtly revise the script my culture has written for me. If my path at this point could claim to be about something, this would have to be it. Heightening my mystical receptivity to experiences that don't fit into our rationalistic view of the world. Psychic phenomena are like flowers, writes parapsychologist William Broad, whose distinctiveness, brightness, beauty and perfume attract attention, inspire awe, and compel approach. Slowly but surely, I am becoming a psychic gardener. I notice things I never noticed before. And now, our interview with Bree Saucy of Milagro Roots.
We have with us today on New World Witchery, Bree Saucy, who is the founder and sacred artist in residence of Milagro Roots, where she teaches courses on star magic, diagnostic tarot, urban root magic, ritual, and many other topics. She comes from a syncretic and eclectic background, blending a number of folk magical traditions and sources, some of which are highly New World related and influenced, and so we are extremely happy to have her with us here on New World Witchery today. So, Bree, welcome.
Thank you so much, Corey. Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you on today, and I want to start with a question might come a little out of left field, but who is Mama Hen?
Mama Hen is not at all a left field question. So she is my mom, and Mama Hen was a name that was given to her not by her magical clients, but by the kids I went to school with when I was really little. They called her Mama Hen because her last name is Henderson, and she is really the source for so much of what I do. I grew up in a family of magical practitioners, and the primary practitioner is my mother, and so she taught me tarot when I was, I have a really vivid memory of being 3 years old and reading cards at her knee in our old house in the living room. And she also was my first astrology teacher, and she inherited many of her gifts from her father, who was a very gifted plant and root man is what we would say, and also her maternal grandmother, who was a midwife in the tiny East Texas town where they grew up. So, you know, she really, my mom and we still were very close. We live about 20 minutes away. We work together pretty frequently, and she is just an amazing source of knowledge that's really not book learned for the most part. It's very hands-on and experiential. And she comes from a time and from a people who, you know, making magic was part of the daily fabric of tradition. So I owe so much to her, and she's awesome.
Excellent. And I wanted to start with that. I'll say I actually kind of knew who she was because I read your website.
Of course.
But I wanted our listeners to hear that because it's something that not a lot of people experience, is this idea of growing up in a magical worldview, and I actually believe that there are a lot of people who grow up with more of a magical worldview than they realize they do.
Yes, I agree.
And so you clearly come from a background where that's very forefronted and very prevalent, and so you have that from both your mother, your father, your ancestral background, which is really wonderful. And I just wanted people to kind of hear where you're coming from, and also hear the aspect of that it's not all book learned, which is very, very important. I think there's nothing wrong with books. I love books. Books are my life.
So I hear you.
I do enjoy them so much, but I also think there's a lot of value to this oral tradition, that you can get through family connections and through learning from others. And that's a big part of what you do, from what I understand.
It is. And, you know, I think something that I'm a huge reader. You know, I have a master's degree, so I like books, I like education, I'm totally down for all of that. But something that I have come across, especially since I started practicing full-time the sacred arts, as I refer to them, are people who will, I mean, you know, they will know someone who is magical. They will be studying with somebody who is actually out there in the world doing magical work, and if that person tells them something or shows them something that disagrees with something that they've read, they tend to take the book over the personal experience. And I think that that's a real, I wouldn't say problem, but I would say it's an obstacle to learning a lot of these traditions the way that they have throughout time been taught. And so I do feel very blessed that, you know, half of my family, the Catholic half of my family, was pretty well educated. But the Baptist half of my family, you know, what they were educated in was the land and the seasons and the stewardship of the land and the way that we work with magic to cultivate that. And so they weren't you know, they were not book learned. And the only book that they really were familiar with was the Bible. And so that's been a huge gift. And it took me a few years to really recognize it as the gift that it is too. But I'm really glad that I have both strains running through me. And I think that that practicing with people who know the hands-on work is really, really important and still to some degree undervalued.
Yes, I think that's something that will resonate with a lot of people is this idea of there's a total value for academia and a total value for book learning, but there's also a value for experience and practice. And I think that you do a really good job of blending both. You provide really excellent texts with your courses, which I'll go ahead and disclose. I've actually taken one of Bree's courses on Star Magic, which was an excellent course.
Oh, thank you.
But the value of that was not the book was wonderful, but the value of it was honestly in the audio lessons and getting to hear in a teacher's voice from experience and hear from the experiences of the other people in the class. There was really some extra value in that you can't get out of books. So I wanted to say thank you for that and kind of branch off from that topic to talk a little bit about what called you to doing this sacred work and especially to teaching.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, we have no lack of really amazing teachers, and I was called to do the work full-time. I had read, like, in college, I would read Thoreau for people for a few bucks here and there, you know, it's like buy yourself Friday night dinner kind of a deal. And I had grown up with it, and I had not, growing up, I was very type A, and I did not think I would fall into this work. What happened is I had a bookstore in San Francisco, and I started having people come in on the weekends, and they would bring me cookies, or they would bring me, like, a latte, and they would ask me if I could read their cards or listen to what was going on and give them some advice. And finally, it got sort of, you know, grew into this thing, and I had a few people say, you should really do this, and then a dear teacher and mentor of mine said, you should do this full time. When she was reading my cards for me, she said, you know, you really should do this full time. And so I really fell into it very naturally. It was kind of those things, you know, we talk about road opening a lot, and it was very much like, this is the road. It is open. Please go down it. And so I decided to do that and started full time in 2009, and it really just grew very organically. And then the teaching component, I did not think I would take on teaching. That was not part of the original plan, but I had students who were, I had clients who were coming to me who were asking me to teach them. They, you know, they would like buy a reading, but it would turn into like a one-on-one teaching session. And then I started hearing people who had a lot of, in my opinion, off ideas. You know, they had taken ideas from several different sources and kind of mashed them together in ways that didn't seem quite right. And there was just a lot of, you know, bad information that I was encountering. So I started teaching with the Miracle Tree sessions, which basically I took 20 years of my experience in magic that, you know, started when I was young and then grew when I ran a women's circle in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and just, you know, all of the different experiences I had, and I codified it. And I really did that for myself, first and foremost. And then I realized, oh, I have a body of work that I can share with other people. And I opened it up and people came. And so, again, it was a really organic thing. And then from there, you know, people started asking specific questions. And I realized that one place where there seemed to be a lack was in taking a magical system like, say, astrology or tarot and applying it to folk magic forms, showing how you would derive ritual or folk magic from the information that you get in these systems, which, of course, is not a new idea. I mean, this is how they were used for hundreds and hundreds of years, but I think something happened probably in the 1800s where we started to lose that connection between here's a system and here's the way that you bring it down to earth through a ritual form. And so that sort of has become one of the focuses of my teaching.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about that separation, you know, in the 1800s, where, you know, up to a certain point there had been a sort of a lived cosmology of miracle and magic. You know, I know a lot of people in the 19th century would not have called what they were doing magic for a lot of reasons.
That's right. Yes.
for whatever term they wanted to use, there was an enchanted worldview that was dominant up to a certain point. And then it did sort of start to segregate into, you know, obviously this sort of, you know, well, there's this practical side of life and then there's the spiritual side of life and never the twain shall meet. And I think what you're doing is a really interesting way of reblending sort of daily life, daily practice of, you know, not even spiritual things, but really just daily activities, you know, cleaning. You do a course on house cleaning that incorporates these magical elements, which I think is just enchanting.
Yeah, I love how you put that we had an enchanted worldview that then we lost. And, you know, and I think that's exactly right. And there have been some really good scholarly books, as you know, that have been written about that. One of my favorites is Religion and the Decline of Magic. And, you know, I mean, this is something that philosophers, you know, straight up academic philosophers have talked about. You know, another thing that came through for me in my teaching that might be my favorite thing is helping people rediscover how their inherited family traditions hold magic in them. And you know, I've had so many clients come to me who say, you know, well, I don't have, you know, I was raised this way or I was raised this way. There is no magic in my tradition. And, you know, we go back a couple of generations and sure enough, there's always a grandmother or an aunt or some family member who, you know, prayed in a certain way or, you know, prepared food in a certain way. And so we start to see that magic is not this thing that is over here, but that it's been woven throughout all of our traditions. All of our ancestors had a relationship with enchantment. So I think that's a beautiful way to put it.
Absolutely. I mean, and people tend to focus on magic. They think of it as this complete, fully packaged system where if they don't have a litany of rituals that they can turn to in their family, you know, grimoire, then it doesn't exist. Whereas, you know, maybe their mom wouldn't sweep under their feet because she had a superstition about that, or they always put blue bottles in the windows to make sure that, you know, there are these little pieces that add up to a whole practice if you really try.
That's right. You know, in my family, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather he was half Cherokee and he was half Irish. And one of the first pieces of magic I was exposed to is as soon as I had my first haircut when I was, you know, 1 year old or one and a half or whenever, he took the first lock of that and he put it in like a plastic film and he carried that on his body every single day until the day he died. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and that was, and it was, he was, you know, it was a piece of protective magic that he did. And I was born with some serious health issues and, you know, and overcame them. So it really worked. And, you know, and that's, you know, it's so easy to look at that and say, oh, that's just a superstition or a little idiosyncratic thing. But it was really a form of magic that had been in his family for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things I really value about your teaching and your teaching style is that you put a lot of importance on one-to-one time. You make yourself available for students for one-to-one phone calls or small group sessions. Can you explain a little bit about why that is so important to you?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's two reasons. The first reason is that it's the best way I have found that I personally learn. I think that big groups of people are great, and there's absolutely a time and a place, and, you know, hats off to people who organize those types of events. But I really value not just question and answer, but I value dialogue. I value conversation. I think sometimes it takes a while to get warmed up. And everyone is coming, or at least in my world, the people that I teach, the people I work with, everyone is coming from a very different background. I mean, my students range from white collar professionals who are really kind of rediscovering this aspect of themselves for the first time to seasoned magical practitioners who are highly initiated in various traditions and schools of thought, but who want to learn about my approach. And so, you know, I think that small group work or one-on-one group work is really the best way to kind of elicit where the individual student is and where they need help. And I don't think that teaching is, when it's done correctly, you know, I don't think that it can be a one-size-fits-all kind of approach. That's why, even though, you know, I have a lot of people who want to just buy the book of a course I do, like I'm about to do Diagnostic Tarot next week, and I've had a lot of people who have said, can I just get the book? And, you know, I haven't made the book available, and one of the reasons why is because the teaching isn't really in the book. Like, the book is there as a supplement, but the teaching is in the conversation and in the spontaneity that comes up in the conversation. When somebody asks a question or shares a story, you know, that takes us off in a specific direction, and that kind of thing can't be planned. And I find that in a larger group, that energy gets different, you know, and it does have to become more of a let's talk and let's teach on a level that's accessible to everyone instead of really kind of fine-tuning it and customizing it for, you know, the specific person that I'm talking with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as, you know, just drawing from personal experience with your Star Magic course, you know, I used the book that you provided, which was an excellent book, again, but I use it more as a touch point and a reference if I get sort of stuck working with something.
Exactly.
And the conversations that you would have, you know, I couldn't be live on a lot of those conversations, but I would listen to them the next day and send in emails immediately, you know, responding to what I'd heard. Because the conversation, your ability to say, okay, well, let's look at your chart, you know, so-and-so, and say, let's do some hands-on practice with a chart and see what the situation looks like and what the prognosis is, that was far more valuable than being able to, you know, look at the book and you know, do a theoretical example. It was much more valuable to have a practical one, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, in my people, like half of my people ancestrally, you know, they taught and they learned orally. You know, my maternal grandfather, who's a huge influence on my practice, had to go to school in the eighth grade to go farm for his family. I mean, that was required. And so he actually taught himself. He was very well educated on his own and by his own lights. But my people are oral people, and so that just, you know, it had to become, that had to be woven into however I teach, because I think it's how we learn.
Definitely. One of the things that you do that I think is very interesting is on your website you feature a lot of other spiritual workers, and you sort of give them a chance to get exposure and get some information about their practice, even when those practices are quite different than something that you do. I think that's very interesting that you're able to build these sort of networks of spiritually minded, sincere magical practitioners. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of building an interfaith and magical network?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is a deep love of mine. So, you know, we talk a lot, I think, in the world of folk magic and, you know, in the world of New World magic, we talk a lot about tradition and lineage and all of that. And all of those things are really beautiful. They're very dear to my heart. They're really important. One of the dangers with too much of an emphasis on those aspects is, of course, a kind of tribalism or a kind of jingoism, where we're not widening the circle. We're not inviting everyone to have a place at the table. And you know, many branches, which is the series that you're referring to on my blog, that started because I was seeing people who were not in my magical world, but they were obviously doing magical work. And I wanted to know more about them. I wanted to reach out and say, hey, tell me about this. Like, tell me how you got into this. And, you know, I mean, I've featured mythic artists in many branches, and I featured people who do work through film and through video. I mean, there are so many different people out there who are working through various modalities. And it really started from just a selfish place of, I want to get to know these individuals. They seem like they're really rocking it, and they have a really unique approach. But then, It grew into wanting to cultivate a sense of community and collaboration among sacred artists, because I really do believe, this is very much the Libra speaking, I really do believe that, you know, we stand stronger when we stand together. And I think that with the internet, with, you know, all of the ability that we have to share information, really taking the time to talk to individual practitioners who may be doing stuff very different than you, but nevertheless have insights to give is so essential and important. And so I really wanted to foster that and not stay just kind of like in the beautiful forest of folk magic, never venturing out to see what was, you know, happening in the lands beyond.
Mm-hmm. And there's a term that you use for all of these people that I really love, and you did an excellent post on this term, and I'd love for you to sort of define and explain what you mean by sacred artist.
Yeah, so sacred artist is a term that I probably started using it about a year and a half ago, and, you know, it came out of, again, a really personal frustration with how do I describe myself when people ask me what I do. You know, I can say I'm a tarot reader, but that's not the whole of what I do. I can say I'm a tarot reader, astrologer, ritualist, teacher, writer, but like that takes forever. And you just get tired of saying it after a while. So I was thinking, well, how do I, how do I talk about this? And I was reading a blog on Terry Wynn Lane's blog, Myth and More, which is, I highly recommend, she's fabulous. And she was talking about, she had been talking to artists about shamanism, and of course a lot has been written about the parallels between art making and the kind of spirit journey that we see in what we would broadly call shamanism. And so I got into a conversation about this with my husband, who is a very gifted visual artist, and he told me, you know, he informed me that I was an artist, and I had never thought of myself as an artist, because I'm not a visual artist, but he, you know, I was standing in front of my altar. I was actually, like, rearranging my altar while we were speaking, and he was like, this is your composition, you know, this is what you do, and this is your art. And so I really let that sink in, and the term sacred artist was born out of that realization that, you know, I know so many people who their modality, their medium, is their understanding of the sacred. And what they're really doing is they're creating art with and by means of their sacred practice and their sacred work. And so I thought, you know, instead of bifurcating and saying, oh, well, he's a hoodoo root man, and she's a, you know, high priestess, gardnerian, Wiccan. I mean, those titles are fine, but really what I see us all holding in common is the sacred arts, and that we are artists working with and through and for our understanding of what's sacred.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I really like that sort of idea, that definition. It reminds me a lot. There's an author I like, Drya Mikaharitz, who focuses a lot. I mean, he's very syncretic, blends a lot of different sources, but he sort of approaches it all as like he essentially refers to it as spiritual work.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this idea of sacred art as well. There's something about that whole person perspective that I think is very refreshing. What do you have, any favorite work that you like to do? Anything that you specifically enjoy the most?
Well, magically speaking, like from a ritual perspective, I really love reconciliation work, which I know is like bizarre because so many people don't like reconciliation work. But I like it because my understanding of reconciliation goes a lot deeper than, oh, I'd really like to get back together with my ex. Mm-hmm. I take reconciliation in almost a theological perspective of, you know, when we seek out reconciliation, we are seeking out a renewed union, a renewed partnership with our sense of ourselves, and also, in many cases, with our understanding of what is most holy. Of course, remembering that holy derives from an old English word that means whole, you know, to be made whole, to be made one or complete. So I find that with my clients, because, you know, they've read enough about me and they know that there's not going to be any simple or quick fixes when they come to me. You know, we're going to do work, and I'm going to work with them and for them, but I'm also going to ask them to do work on their own. My clients come to me expecting that, and I find that, you know, in many cases, reconciliation work can go very deep and can mend or provide a healing balm for a lot of hurts that people have experienced that go way beyond this specific situation at hand that first causes them to contact me. So I really love that. And then I love cleansing and banishing work. I really like getting in and, you know, saying, okay, we need to create a ritual bath, or we need to create a cleansing ceremony to really wash this off or let this go. And we need to get rid of stuff. Let's take stuff out.
Excellent. And how do you, I know just from doing some work myself that it's not always sunshine and daisies.
That's
and
right.
People approach you for some things that occasionally can be very, very difficult. How do you deal with darker aspects of folk magic? And I don't necessarily mean, you know, throwing curses or things like that, but even, you know, reconciliation work can have a darker side sometimes.
Definitely.
Fidelity work can have a dark side. Court work can have a dark side. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, my attitude, first of all, as a teacher, I'm very honest about that. In fact, it's funny because, again, I start Diagnostic Tarot next week, and the very first lesson is on baneful work within the Tarot, and we're going to be focusing on cards like the Devil and the Tower. And I had a few students email me because they were concerned about that. And as a teacher, the baneful work, the coercive work, the controlling work, the compelling work, that is a part of every tradition that I know of that is grounded in history and in primary source material. I mean, you just do a very cursory glance over our magical heritage and you see it. And so it's there, and I think that trying to, you know, gild it or, you know, take it out or keep it out of the conversation does way more harm than it does good. So I'm very upfront about the fact that, you know, any tradition can be used or can be emphasized in a coercive, compelling, edgier, sometimes is the way I talk about it, manner. Personally, my philosophy on ritual work and on magic is that you really, when somebody comes to me, we're really working on them. We're working on the way that they're holding the situation. We're working with the way that they engage in the situation. Sometimes it's very practical. You know, a lot of times I find that one of the core problems is a lack of communication, and that often stems from someone not being able to articulate how they feel or what they think, or not feeling safe in doing so. You know, they have the words, but they don't feel like they have the safety or the courage to actually say them. So, you know, I focus on the person who's come to me, and the work that I do centers around the person who has come to me, as opposed to we're going to force someone to do this or we're going to try to force someone to do that. And that comes somewhat from my own moral stance, but it also comes from a results-oriented stance, because what I see is controlling, compelling, edgier work having a momentary effect, but often not having a long-term effect. And when you've grown up in a magical world, as I have 33 years of experience, you know, seeing, oh, how did that work? Like, at the end of the day, how did that compelling ritual really work out? And often the results are not what the person intended. So I work with a person who comes to me, and we work on their role in whatever is going on. And so because of that, I don't have a lot of people asking me to do things, you know, more compelling, coercive types of work on them. Usually people would like to not do that to themselves. Now, there's another whole part of course, folk magic, generally speaking, that a lot of people think of as edgier or kind of scarier, that to me is home, and that's graveyard work. And I'm very comfortable working with my ancestors. I'm very comfortable in graveyards. I always have been. And so, you know, working with departed spirits and working with the dead is something that it's, you know, I never thought of it as scary. I never thought of it as off in any way. Definitely, you know, you have to be careful, but I think you have to be careful in waking life. You know, there are parts of town you don't go to during certain times, and the same thing is true when you're working with the realm of the dead and the ancestors, but they feel very familial and close to me. So a lot of people who find that work unsettling, I don't share that view.
Yes, and a lot of it has to do with, I think some of the people who, I won't say they get scared of graveyard work, but encounter the scarier aspects of that, some of that happens because they're treating it as a one and done phenomenon, and it's not. It's a relationship. In any culture that you find a lot of, you know, necromantic or graveyard oriented work, there's a relationship that has to be developed between the worker and the spirits of the dead. So
absolutely. And, you know, growing up in the Southwest, I mean, Dia de los Muertos was something that we always celebrated, and you know, just ever since I was really young, like, we've talked to our dead, we've talked to our ancestors, you know, we have a sense that they hold space for us. So to me, that's like working with beloved family members.
Absolutely. Well, Bree, do you have any current or upcoming projects that you can tell us about? I know you've said that you've got your diagnostic tarot class beginning very soon.
That begins on Monday, and registration is closed. But what I am doing, and what I do, and I recommend that listeners, you know, check back the website, you know, every now and then, is I have something that I just started a few months ago called a community altar. So this was for people who wanted ritual work, or they wanted ceremony, but they couldn't afford like the big packages that I offer. That was just, it was too expensive, or it was too much for what they wanted. Like they have a smaller issue that needs to be addressed. So I created what I call a community altar, where I usually limit it to about 20 spots, and I'm doing one for solstice, where we're focusing on alchemy, and we're taking something everybody is sending, who does it, sends in a petition of what they have right now and what they would like it to transform to. And I'm doing a big bonfire, because my family loves bonfires. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a big bonfire. We're using that fire and focusing that fire on being the kind of fire that you would find heating up an alchemical crucible. And so everybody's petitions will go into the fire. The ashes will be ritually disposed of. In this case, they'll be buried, actually, at the foot of a very old oak tree that I work with. And then I'm making oil for everyone who signs up for it. And so the oils will be sent out. They will be made on solstice and, of course, charged under that beautiful summer sun. So that is something. And I do those not every month, but I do them several times a year. So that's always good. And then my newsletter, I send out a newsletter twice a month for the full moon and the new moon. And there's always a little divination exercise that people can do, because I really love helping people pick up these skills for themselves. I mean, I don't think that there's any shortage of work for those of us who professionally read cards, you know, provide divination, do ritual work. But I love teaching people how to engage with these arts on whatever level feels right for them. So the whole point of the newsletters is to tell them astrologically, okay, this is what's going on, you know, here are some themes to be aware of, and then to provide a little divination exercise that they can do on the new moon and on the full moon, just to help develop skills and keep skills sharp. So, and people love that. They always get a lot out of it. I put a lot of time into it because, you know, I like to write letters to my people. So those are two offerings that are ongoing that people can definitely take advantage of.
Excellent. And I receive those newsletters regularly. And I'll say I've signed up for plenty of newsletters, and a lot of times they'll come through and I just sort of, oh, okay, that's from this person. I'll store that one away for later and never read it again. But yours, I always open them up. I'm always excited to see them in my inbox.
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. You know, I get that a lot about my newsletters, and it always makes me so happy because I do put a lot of time in them, and I'm glad that they are of use and of benefit to everyone who receives them. So thank you. That's really kind.
They're wonderful. And so that's all I have for today. Bree, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. And I hope that our listeners are taking away from this what sacred artistry is, because I really think you've done a good job of showing that both in your practice and in this conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Thank you so much, Corey. I really appreciate it. And thank you to all the listeners as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Bree.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
If your witchcraft grows betwixt the roots and weeds of your garden,
or between the cracks of your busy life, get a cup of tea,
pull up a chair, and join us for Betwixt
and Between, a podcast of chats between
two modern traditional witches.
If you're not too busy.
And your kids asleep.
Our final reading tonight comes from Jaya Mikaharitz's Spiritual Cleansing, which is a short handbook on all sorts of cleansing and protection rituals based on a variety of folk magic systems, including Central European magical systems, which is what Mr. Mikaharitz was raised with. And then things like hoodoo and root work also show up in his work as well. Again, he's a very syncretic practitioner, but not in any way derisive or appropriative of the material or the cultures that he's drawing upon. He's very good about giving credit to them, very good about sort of presenting them from a sympathetic perspective. So at any rate, what I wanted to read to you tonight is a section from his introduction to that book. It's this section called The Spiritual Man, and it talks a good bit about sort of the worldview that he's coming from, the worldview of those who may have sort of a spiritual lifestyle that depends upon an enchanted worldview. So it's just something that I thought reflected very well with the material in this episode, and I hope you agree. If not, I hope you find it entertaining or at least somewhat informative. And if not that, then I hope it doesn't put you to sleep while you're driving and cause you to have a car wreck. So, whatever the case, let's read from Jaya Mikaharitz's Spiritual Cleansing. It has often been said that everything on this earth is surrounded by a spiritual energy field, but this is not to be confused with the field of magnetic flux which surrounds a magnet. The spiritual energy field, like the quality or vibration of people, places, and things, is not detectable through the physical senses. Once we can make a distinction between the physical and the spiritual parts of the human constitution, it becomes easy to understand just how spiritual cleansing works. If we can agree that every living thing carries within it its own vibration, and that vibration results from the field of invisible energy which surrounds it, we can understand how we can use the energy of one part of the created universe to work with the human energy field and remove unwanted detritus from it. In a way, it is just like using a combination of fat and lye, that we call soap, to scrub the human physical body to remove dirt. In both cases, one part of the created universe is used to remove unwanted material from the body, physical or spiritual, of an incarnate human being. Every inanimate object, every home, building, piece of furniture, and article of clothing carries traces of the energy of the animate being to which it has been exposed. The energies of those who made the object, those who sold it, and those who previously owned it are impregnated into the spiritual fabric or spiritual body of everything that exists. The spiritual body of the incarnate human being interacts with the spiritual energy field of its surroundings, both in terms of people and places. A physical analogy takes place in hypnosis, for an individual can recall subtle points of his surroundings in great detail, although he may not be consciously aware that he even saw the details. Our eyes interact with physical environment in such a way that we are actually able to remember the details of the wallpaper pattern in the waiting room at the doctor's office that we visited at age 3. We could also recall the smells and textures of that office while hypnotized, but it is more difficult to communicate these observations to others because we lack a common standard of comparison. No matter how much time we spend in any given physical location, our spiritual natures, as discrete observers, will recall the entire surroundings in detail. Obviously, if we are to spend too much time around someone or something that has a strong negative vibration, we may accept it into ourselves and be affected by it. Once this occurs, our own spiritual vibration may suffer. Spiritual cleansing will remove this negative vibration and restore our own, just as washing our hands removes the dirt acquired from necessary household chores. Years ago, this kind of information was common knowledge. It was passed from one family to another, one generation to another. Today we regard some of this information as old wives' tales or superstition, but it isn't. Our world has changed a great deal in the last 100 years, and even more rapidly in the last 50. While we have gained from the scientific material progress we have made, these gains came to us at a price. The loss of some of the knowledge of our spiritual natures. We have lost a part of our old knowledge. We can fly from New York to Los Angeles in a matter of hours, but we also mingle our energy fields with hundreds or even thousands of people who are strangers to us. Our physical senses report the airplane flight to us in all its details, but we receive no such report of the consequences of intermingling our energy fields with so many people. Only those few people with finely attuned spiritual senses are aware of the difficulty that such mingling may bring. In the old days, we lived a quiet life. We seldom saw anyone outside the family structure. Many people lived an entire lifetime on a farm or in a small town. In 1900, many thought it was a great event to travel twice a year to a town 20 or 50 miles away in order to do seasonal shopping. People were intimately familiar with their personal surroundings, and they kept them clean. There were few strangers among us. When strangers did arrive, we knew how to cope with the energy field they brought with them. Every home had its protective charms, and every family had its household rituals. When I was a boy, growing up in rural settings of Central Europe, well over 50 years ago, it would have been unthinkable for us to go to bed until my grandmother had swept a pinch of salt at the front door and my grandfather had barred the doorway with a heavy bar that closed it for the night. We then said our prayers, asking God's protection on us as we slept. Only then did we retire to bed, feeling as protected and secure as if we lived in the greatest castle in Hungary. Protection keeps us from harm, and spiritual cleansing removes harm once it's occurred. Most families no longer have household rituals to keep them from harm, but many ethnic groups, the use of talismans and charms is still practiced. I see people from the Mediterranean countries wearing golden horn charms to ward off the evil eye. Many Christians wear the cross around their neck as a charm. All religions have their own form of protective amulet. We tend to forget the significance of our religious rituals, for we participate in them in a group, and no one tells us why we do what we do. Years ago, a person's religion signified his way of life. Today, all too often, our stated religion is a name-only philosophy. We forget about it all week and go to church or temple only for social reasons because the ritual holds no meaning for us. Some people may know the outer meaning of the ritual of their inherited religion, but seldom know what the ritual means symbolically. Rarely do people understand the rituals connected with the religious creed other than their own. All religions, though, have one thing in common, a ritual designed to keep a believer spiritually clean. Many people still yearn for rituals that appeal to the forces of nature or the forces of God, because in the old days we could worship that way. These rituals appeal to something deep inside us, and we feel better after we've participated in them. These rituals have the greatest spiritual cleansing effect on us because they touch and stir those non-physical parts of our being of which we are not ordinarily aware. Well, that's it for tonight. I hope that you all enjoyed this episode. Again, please forgive me if there are any flubs or sound screw-ups. I know we've got a few stutters and uhs and ahs floating around in here. So please forgive those when they do show up. We try to edit those out as much as possible, but just have not had as much time to do that this month as normal. We will plan to release another episode in August, I believe. If this one comes out in August, then the other episode will come out near the end of August, or it may get pushed back to September, and we may miss July entirely, which I hope doesn't happen, but you never know. That's about it for us today. I highly encourage you to check out Bree's website. We're really, really grateful that she came on our show, and really, really thankful for her doing the interview with us. Highly encourage you to sign up for her courses as well. They're very, very much worth it. She made astrology very, very clear to me in a way that no one else has ever been able to do. I'm very, very thick-headed when it comes to certain things with astrology, so it was very refreshing to take her course and kind of get a feel for exactly how these things worked. And that being said, that doesn't mean I'm an expert on astrology after taking one course from her, but what it does mean is that I feel like I kind of understand some of the groundwork that has eluded me for a long time. And so now with these people who have really, really intense knowledge of astrology, like Jason from Cosmophilia, for example, they can do this, you know, without missing a beat, and, you know, in their sleep. And for me, it was always a real struggle, but the course with Bree, made it a lot less of a struggle for me. And it makes me, really appreciate what people like Jason are able to do a whole lot more. It's just such a phenomenal thing. At any rate, so that's enough of me gushing, I guess. But thank you so much for listening tonight. We will be back again soon. If you have any questions, you can always email us at compassandkey@gmail.com. You can read all of our posts and entries on various types of New World magic and magical traditions at newworldwitchery.com. You can find us on Twitter at @NWWITCHERY. Or you can find us on Facebook. Just find facebook.com/newworldwitchery. That's us. That's it for tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Be well.